Hello, and welcome to Resurrected Reviews Revisited, part of the Will You Still Love It Tomorrow podcast. I'm Annie, and in each reviews episode, I pick something I've reviewed sometime since 2005, reread or rewatch it, and then compare my reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers. This month, my pick is The Secret History by Donna Tartt. Before revisiting it, my recollections, which may or may not be completely wrong, are as follows. It's a book that was published, I want to say, in the 90s, and it's one that people talk about as having a really shocking twist, which I don't remember at all. In fact, I remember very little about this book, other than that it's about a group of university students who do something terrible that has repercussions for their later lives. And I also think I read it about 10 or 12 years ago and really didn't like it. So why am I doing this again? Looking up the book now, I discover it was actually written in 1992, so I was right about that at least. It's from the perspective of Richard, who goes to a small college in Vermont and is attracted to a group of elitist classic students. He persuades their charismatic tutor to let him join their classes and then gets wrapped up in events after the group kills a farmer during an attempt at holding a Dionysian bacchanal. The only other member of the group not present for this ritual is Bunny, who threatens to inform the police when he finds out about it later. So the others murder him too, and the rest of the book is about how they each deal with the aftermath. Anyway, here are my detailed thoughts on rereading this book in 2024. I decided I want these solo episodes to be at least 15 minutes long, but I was worried I wouldn't have enough to say about a single book to make that length. This shouldn't have been a concern, since this script is way longer than I intended, so buckle up, listeners, we're going in. My first thought on the book arriving in the post was, wow, that's a big book. It's 630 pages with quite small type, so perhaps not the best idea for my first foray back into revisiting reviews. I'm also not remotely claiming to be any kind of authority on books, or that my thoughts as I read them are profound in any way, so I'm not quite sure why anybody would want to listen to me waffle on about The Secret History for half an hour, but we are where we are. The opening line was immediately familiar, but perhaps more because it's one of those that's used for quiz questions on occasion, and actually did come up as a quiz question in the pub quiz that I was at on the Monday before recording this, so that was quite coincidental, and I got the point for that one. So perhaps it's more that than because I actually remembered it from reading the book before. And that line is, "The snow in the mountains was melting, and Bunny had been dead for several weeks before we came to understand the gravity of our situation." And it occurred to me after finishing the book and hearing that in the quiz question that this is pure clickbait, since their situation is never actually really grave, because nobody really suspects that Bunny was murdered, so they're not really in any danger from the authorities at any point. Anyway, the book has a classic structure prologue that introduces the shocking detail that the narrator and his friends have committed a murder, and then it goes back in time for a long, slow build-up back to that point in the story. I assume that it's remembering this structure, which is often used in thrillers, that made me also think The Secret History was pacey and plot-driven, when it's exactly the opposite. So I'm already questioning my sanity, because what do we have to base our reality on but our memories? And my memories of this book are absolute nonsense. The prologue gives no information at all about the narrator, no name, no age, no gender, nothing, which does make it a bit hard to latch onto them as a character or form any opinions about them. Though all of those things are given immediately on the first page of chapter one, so at least it doesn't take long to get them. It's interesting for a female author to write in the first person from a male point of view. The protagonist of my first novel was male, admittedly, but it wasn't first person, so I find that interesting. The language overall is quite pretentious, but in a way that I have to admit did appeal to me, as well as it being vividly descriptive. But it does seem out of keeping for the protagonist, because his background is very different to the typical liberal arts college type student you might imagine. His father runs a gas station, and his mother answers the phone in a factory. That said, the narrative is being written quite a few years in the future from the events being described, and that's after he spent a lot of time as a classic student. So I suppose the regular smattering of Latin and the overblown sentence structure kind of makes sense from that perspective. The initial presentation of the five Greek students, Henry, Francis, Charles, Camilla and Bunny, is very effective in showing them as a group to aspire to be part of. Rich's fascination with them is very credible, and I do love the image when he finally makes contact of characters in a favourite painting suddenly coming to life to speak to him, because he's been viewing them from a distance for a few weeks by that point. Of course, everything is overshadowed by the knowledge that the other four and Richard do conspire to murder Bunny before too long, which adds a definite tension to the otherwise largely mundane narrative. It's also lent an almost dreamlike quality by the atmosphere of the small archaic college and Julian Morrow's even smaller, oh-so-exclusive group of students. It's all very romantic and mysterious, which is at odds with the inevitable violence. First major red flags: when Julian says he'll take Richard on as a student, he also tells Richard he'll need to switch to Julian being his student counsellor and drop most of his other classes, because he'll be taking four or five classes per term with just Julian. So Richard's immediately almost completely cut off from any other society than Julian and his little group. And the narrator's apparent awareness of this is rather baldly stated. It says, "I was slightly giddy with the force of his personality, but the extremism of the offer was appealing as well." I think this is possibly where another issue with my memory comes in, because the focus at the beginning is on Julian and how charismatic he is, and his influence on the story isn't as great as I thought it was. Once Richard starts attending the classes, I have to admit I was transported so vividly back to my own university years, when Professor Wordsworth used to make us sit on the floor in a circle around a life-size bust of his namesake poet, which sat on a mock stone plinth surrounded by daffodils. And I have to admit, I did relate to Richard quite a bit, feeling inferior in the company of the beautiful people who were erudite and eloquent and everything I wanted to be at the time. So I do understand where he is at the beginning of the book and why he wants to be part of it. Overall, though, the sense of foreboding and the significance laid upon everything by the knowledge of the eventual outcome is pretty heavy-handed. It's all presented as extremely portentous, but I would say it's overdone. But some of the imagery, on the other hand, is amazing. One quote I particularly liked: "I almost bumped into Dr. Rowland coming in the door. At first, he didn't seem to know who I was, but just when I thought I was going to get away, the creaky machinery of his face began to grind, and a cardboard dawn of recognition was lowered with jerks from the dusty proscenium." So that was pretty cool. Bunny does seem pretty appalling on first proper introduction. He takes Richard out to lunch and is presented as boorish, bigoted, self-important and crass, continually expressing offensive views and then trying to land Richard with the excessive bill after previously telling him he would pay. But his behaviour does allow the narrative to show Henry and the twins in a much more sympathetic light, as Henry rescues Richard from the restaurant and apologises for Bunny's actions, and the twins later invite Richard to dinner at their house after connecting over the incident. So that is kind of how he gets to become part of the group. Bunny, however, is an established part of the group and Richard is not, so he does remain on the outside to a certain extent while Bunny continues to be tolerated for reasons that I don't really understand. Once Richard attends the first weekend away at Francis's country house and becomes part of the group more properly, there's a lovely bit where he talks about how the rest of them were as bewildered by him as he was by them, and it's a very good exploration of making erroneous assumptions about what other people are thinking. And then there are moments where the significance of the murder is completely undermined. It does say, "Up until the end, there was always Sunday night dinner at Charles and Camilla's, except on the evening of the murder itself, when no one felt much like eating and it was postponed until Monday. So, after pushing one of their close-knit group off a cliff, they felt compelled to delay their usual weekly dinner by a whole day." I mean, it doesn't, like, suggest that they've been massively affected by what they've done. When Richard talks about getting to know them better, he mentions growing closer to them all each individually and describes what activities he does with them, but Bunny is never presented in a good light, and it doesn't say anything about Richard growing to like him as it does with the others. So right from the start, he's kind of not the same as the others and presented as not obviously deserving to die, but that's possibly one of the tactics used to suggest that we want to sympathise with them. The murder tease notwithstanding, there's quite a lot of heavy, little did I know foreboding about other things, which is a common flaw in narratives that are written as if the viewpoint character is telling the story to someone after the fact, and this does usually elicit some eye-rolling from me. I think if you have to keep drawing the reader on with blatantly stated promises of shocks to come, you're not giving the story enough credit to be its own best advocate. But the tension in Richard's existence between the fabrication that his background matches those of the other students, rich, carefree, not bothered by financial worries or concerns about what they'll do after they graduate, and his actual circumstances, needing to work over the holidays to support his studies and not being wanted back home by his parents, is well portrayed. It kind of reminds me of a cross between the first half of Brideshead Revisited, with the dreamy idealised college existence and the slightly unhealthy friendship between young men of different stations, and The Talented Mr. Ripley, with the sinister undertones and the protagonist pretending to be rich when he isn't. And at page 150, it suddenly picks up the pace and mystery, with Richard discovering that the twins Henry and Francis are planning a one-way trip to Argentina, and eventually, after all that falls through, Henry reveals that they've been trying to achieve Dionysiac frenzy by holding bacchanals, and that they accidentally killed someone during one of these incidents. Or, well, maybe not accidentally, but they were under the influence of drugs and weird rituals and whatnot, and they weren't really aware of what they were doing. But it's all told in a massive speech by Henry after the fact, and the pace just stops dead again, and the recitation of the whole series of events takes 50 pages. And it also becomes clear that this all happened 4 months before, so the group only start acting weird and being concerned about it several months later when they think they're going to get caught, not because of the death itself. Which doesn't make them very sympathetic, but then I suppose they're not meant to be, despite Richard's fascination with them. Still, the elitist attitude is a bit much. So, quote, "It's a terrible thing what we did," said Francis abruptly. "I mean, this man wasn't Voltaire that we killed, but still, it's a shame. I feel bad about it." Really? It also seems odd that the viewpoint character isn't even there for the inciting incident of the whole book, and is just told about it 4 months afterwards. He does reflect on events from that time suddenly seeming more significant, but we haven't actually been told about any of them when they happened, so it all feels quite remote and kind of contrived. And on top of that, I was previously under the impression that the build-up to why they add Bunny to the body count went on for most of the book, but it turns out we find out the motivation behind it by page 200, because they're worried about him not being able to keep his mouth shut about the other death after he finds out about it. I also remember Julian leading the Bacchanal experiments, but that doesn't seem to be the case. I thought the whole book was about a cult of personality, with Julian at its centre demonstrating how dangerous it is for young impressionable students to be so completely under the influence of one very charismatic teacher. But he's actually barely in the book at all, so again, not very good with the memory. Sidebar, why did the chapters have to be so long? I really hate breaking off reading when it's not the end of a chapter. I know that's a bit stupid, but you know. But that is made rather difficult when the chapters are 40 or 50 pages long, and some of them are over 100 pages long, so structurally, it's not very consistent. And the more we get to see and hear about Bunny, the more I wondered why any of the others were friends with him in the first place. Richard talks about them all being fond of one another, including Bunny, but I can't see why on earth they would be. It's also unclear why Julian took Bunny on as a student when he's apparently far behind where even Richard was at the start of the book, and he doesn't actually have the money to back up his place in the elite tier of society either. It's also interesting to me that while it's true that we're not meant to like or be sympathetic towards the rest of the group, Bunny is by far the worst of them in terms of attitudes and behaviours. As I said, I'm not saying he actually deserves to be killed, but it's definitely written in a way to make us not like him even more than any of the others. It initially seemed impossible to me that the situation as it stands, once Bunny also knows about the death of the farmer, could carry on so long without coming to a head, but then it occurred to me that people do maintain a continuing existence in seemingly untenable circumstances all the time, so it's actually quite realistic, but it does make for quite a torturous narrative in a fiction book in some respects. And then the murder actually happens at almost exactly the halfway point, leaving me wondering what on earth the rest of the book was going to be about. Because I thought the whole book was just the lead up and then the murder happened at the end, but again, don't remember it. It was around this point when Richard starts talking about the repercussions and how years have passed between the murder and his recounting of it, that I realised it's not specified when the events at the college are set or how much a time has passed between the murder happening and his narrative. The book was published in 1992, which I assume forms the present from his perspective when he's telling the story, but it's not clear how long ago the murder was other than years. Weirdly, once the murder's passed, the pace picks up quite a bit, with a lot more direct action and a lot more tension. probably because you as the reader suddenly don't know where it's going anymore, and the characters are in a state of high stress, not knowing when the body will be discovered and what conclusions the authorities might draw. In some ways, the narrative both speeds up and slows down at the same time. Previously, it felt slow because there was a lot of discussion of people's state of mind, long descriptions of places and events without there being much direct action, but it did cover weeks at a time in just a few pages. And then at the start of the second half, it follows what happens to the characters over the course of a few days in a lot of detail. It feels much pacier because it's almost all direct action, and things seem as if they're speeding towards some imminent crisis, even though there's still nearly 300 pages to go. But the time frame slows down because we're following events in much more detail. Total lack of acknowledgement of wrongdoing continues when Henry's questioned by the police once it becomes obvious that Bunny's missing, and his view of this is as follows. He shook his head. Honestly, 2 hours. I don't know if I could have made myself go through with this if I'd known what nonsense we were letting ourselves in for. So the only reason that he regrets doing it is because it's inconveniencing him by him being questioned by the police for so long. And then Francis comes back from spending an evening with Bunny's family, again before the body is discovered, so they're in a state of incredible tension because they don't know where he is or what's happened to him. And Francis is annoyed because one of the kids got a hold of his silk scarf and ruined it. Richard says, "Were they upset? Who, the Corcorans? Of course not. I don't think they even noticed. I don't mean about the scarf." And yet still, purely because they're protagonists of the book, I think, there's a level on which I did want them to get away with it. So the book is very clever in the way it makes you question your perceptions of characters and morality in stories, because just because they're the main characters, you think, oh, we're meant to be rooting for them. It's also interesting that Richard, as the first-person protagonist, essentially remains on the outside of the group for the whole book. He's not involved in the bacchanal that results in the death of the farmer. He doesn't find out about it until months later. And then when the plot to kill Bunny is hatched, he's not supposed to be present for that either, though he does actually turn up and witness it in the end. He's always in the dark about everything. He's continually wondering what's going on and asking the others questions, but not really getting any answers. And that does make for a very meandering, directionless narrative in some ways, without much in the way of real focus. And it also means that nearly all of the most important aspects are revealed in long conversations Richard has, where one of the others finally tells him what's actually been going on, and we're not there for any of it. Even the murder itself, which is just, I mean, it's kind of described on the page, isn't really described on the page at the time it's referred to, but we don't see the details of it until much later. A quote that struck me from a conversation where Richard and Charles are talking about Henry. "You know what I wonder," I said. "What? Not why he tells us what to do, but why we always do what he says." So it's Henry who's the real ringleader, the plan maker, the orchestrator of everything, and not Julian in the least, which is how I remembered it. The characters do become less and less likeable, which I suppose makes sense in a way. When Richard first comes across them, they're figures of mystery and glamour. Then he gets to know them as real people, but only on the surface, so at least Charles and Camilla seem quite nice. But as the book progresses, the layers peel back, and both Richard and the reader see more sides to them. Charles is very possessive of Camilla, and there's the suggestion that their relationship is physically abusive and also perhaps incestuous. Francis doesn't seem to care all that much about consent in his sexual activities, which obviously isn't great. And Henry doesn't really care about any of them other than as pawns to aid his own survival. And since they're all under a great deal of stress, it's believable that they would show worse aspects of themselves as things progress. It's all summed up rather well with these lines. "At one time I had liked the idea that the act, at least, had bound us together. We were not ordinary friends, but friends till death do us part. This thought had been my only comfort in the aftermath of Bunny's death. Now it made me sick, knowing there was no out. I was stuck with them, with all of them, for good." Although that's not really borne out by the book either, because once it all finishes and concludes, he says that he basically loses touch with them all, so not followed through. Richard himself also gets less appealing as the book goes on, even going so far as to think about assaulting Camilla himself after she shows him her bruises and burns, which may or may not have been done by Charles. So, you know, unlikable narrator, unlikable characters. And then the pace suddenly picks up again about 70 pages from the end, with the discovery of a letter Bunny sent to Julian explaining all about the original death and saying that he thought the others were planning to kill him. Julian thinks it's a fake, because he hasn't read the whole thing, but one of the pages is stationery from a hotel where Henry and Bunny stayed in Rome during the winter. So then there's frantic scheming to figure out how they can steal that page and destroy it so it can't be used as evidence that Bunny actually wrote the letter. So it's a lot of tension on that, where they again think they might get caught. And of course it's their attempts to get hold of the page before Julian sees the letterhead that actually lead to him seeing it. And then, after the crisis has come upon them and Henry ends up explaining the whole thing to Julian, Julian just gives him the letter and then abruptly leaves the country, never to be seen again. So, interestingly, the resolution of this point of tension that's actually been building for most of the book increases the sense of suspense as to what's ultimately going to happen at the end, because there's still 50 pages to go, but it's diluted almost immediately because nothing comes of it. And despite the fact that Charles is clearly getting more and more unhinged as time goes by, it's actually not unreasonable for him to be afraid that Henry might kill him if Henry starts to consider him a potential threat, since of course that's exactly what Henry did to Bunny. It all gets surprisingly action-packed and tense at the very end, much more thrillery than it has been up to that point. And weirdly, after all the lengthy in-depth analytical build-up, the climax with Charles waving a gun around and Richard accidentally getting shot and then Henry killing himself seems rather a cheap and tawdry conclusion to the novel, so I was a bit disappointed. And then when Francis subsequently tries to kill himself and fails, he tells Richard he has to get married because his grandfather found out he was gay and threatened to cut him off, and it all just seems a bit dreary. Richard sums up the whole thing very well, I think. The story was simple. It told itself, really. Suicidal Henry, struggle for the gun, leaving me wounded and him dead. In a way, I felt this was unfair to Henry, but in another way, it wasn't. It made me feel better in some obscure way, imagining myself a hero rushing fearlessly for the gun instead of merely loitering in the bullet's path like the bystander which I so essentially am. And that's it exactly. He's a bystander for the whole book. So, yeah, not quite sure how I feel about that. It is a compelling narrative in some ways, but in other ways, none of the action happens on the page and Richard's not really involved, which makes it all a bit at a distance. There were also quite a few apparent inconsistencies that pulled me out of the story. Richard says once he joins Julian's group but doesn't really become part of it, that he's completely isolated within the college because he doesn't interact with any of the other students either, but then also says he's been to every Friday night party since school began, so that doesn't really track. Julian tells him he needs to quit all his other classes apart from French because he'll only be studying with Julian and the rest of the group for his whole time at the college. But then Bunny has an English Lit assignment that he's panicking about at the end of term, which none of the others are also doing. And later Richard makes a comment about Camilla preferring English Lit to Greek, which is odd if she sacrificed all other classes to be in Julian's classics clique. Henry tells Richard that Bunny can't keep his mouth shut and they're worried about him telling people what they've done, and yet Bunny has multiple opportunities to tell Richard, who might be considered a safe confidant, about the death, and he stays silent for more than 5 months, even during occasions when he's drunk and Richard is actually asking him questions about it. Julian tells Richard about Henry's migraines, but when Henry mentions them and asks Richard if he already knew, Richard thinks about Bunny going on and on about them in the past, even though he seems surprised to hear about it from Julian only a couple of days beforehand. Then it says Julian taught a foreign princess at the college 10 years before, and then says Henry caught sight of her once coming out of the Lyceum. But Henry's in his third or fourth year of college, so he wouldn't have been there 10 years before. It's actually generally very confusing how long the others have been there or how long they've known each other. Richard joins Julian's study group a few weeks into the third year of his undergraduate degree because he switches from another college. Though I did miss the one sentence in the first chapter about him doing 2 years at another college, so I thought most of the way through it was his first year. Obviously, Charles and Camilla are twins, so they've known each other their whole lives, and they tell Richard that Henry and Bunny are old friends, which strongly implied to me that they knew each other before going to college. But then much later, Bunny's dad says Bunny and Henry met when they were roommates on first arriving at the college, which would mean they've known each other the same amount of time as the others have known them. And then at one point, Francis refers to a time when he was a sophomore and Charles was a freshman, which puts them in different years. And then towards the end, Richard categorically states that he's in his third year of college, but also that he's expecting to graduate with his degree at the end of that academic year. And I thought American undergraduate courses were always 4 years. And at that point, he's also trying to figure out where he's going to stay for the summer, which implies he's intending to come back to the college the following academic year. Otherwise, he'd be looking at more long-term plans, so that doesn't make sense either. And even so, it's stated definitively that at least Charles and Francis are in different years, so it's really confusing because how would they all be in the same classes? So that kept pulling me out all the way through because I was very confused. In terms of the critique aspect, I've been watching a lot of old BookTube videos by The Book Leo, a young Dutch woman who makes excellent content about books and reading. One of her favourite genres is dark academia, and The Secret History is one of the books held up as where the popularity for this genre started. And in a video what I watched recently, Leonie did a breakdown of what dark academia is. And one of the main aspects she talked about, alongside an outsider joining an exclusive group, an academic setting, obsession and death, was critique, which is often something I miss in books because I don't tend to apply deep analytical skills when I'm reading for pleasure. Anyway, in a later video, Leonie looked at the Goodreads pages of various of her viewers with their consent and psychoanalyzed them in a very humorous way. And for one of them, she said, "I bet it took you a long time to realize you weren't supposed to want to be the characters in A Secret History." And I have to admit, I felt very seen because I think I kind of missed that to begin with. Clearly, though, the critique here is of the elitist nature of the academia at the college and also the assumption of the characters that they are above the law because they're intelligent, well-educated and wealthy. And one of the things Leonie pointed out in her reading vlog about The Secret History, which should have been totally obvious to me, is that the book's critique of elitist academia is epitomised by Richard, who's from a modest background, wanting to learn to be like the others in the group. After all, if he hadn't been attracted to them so much that he fought to be admitted to Julian's classes, he never would have been involved in any of the murdering, the consequences of which he is very clear at the end have blighted his life. I'm thinking, though, that Donatart must have also had a similar level and type of education, otherwise she wouldn't be able to describe the kinds of things the characters are studying and the depth she does. And looking it up, the college in the book is based on the college Donatart actually attended, and several of the characters are apparently based on real people that she knew there, which is interesting to me. The author picture in the back of my copy is incredibly pretentious, but then it is quite difficult for author pictures to be anything else. In terms of diversity, there aren't any demographics specified, but I'm assuming it's 100% white. There is one reference at Bunny's funeral when his football coach says he saved the day in a game against a team from Lower Connecticut, and Francis leans over to Richard and says that means black. So that's a fair indication that there aren't any non-white people in the general environs of the story. Richard mentions early on that he thinks Francis is likely gay, and perhaps Julian too, but it's not discussed in any great detail. Bunny's views on queerness are wildly offensive, but as are his views on a lot of things. There are also offhand comments and dialogue in the narrative itself, views ascribed to both Henry and Richard about homosexuality that aren't great. And then later Francis is definitely established as gay, but also predatory, and he comes on to both Richard and Charles, specifically when they're drunk. And he even admits it himself when Richard asks him, "Who's Charles been to bed with?" Francis brought up his glass and took a big drink. "Me, for one," he said. "That shouldn't surprise you. If you drank as much as he does, I dare say I would have been to bed with you too." So that's not great, because the only definitely queer character is predatory. Richard's very disparaging towards and about several of the female students he has interactions with, while he sets Camilla up on a pedestal as perfect and out of reach, but then also thinks about wanting to assault her, so that's not great either. Having said that, it's not really possible to criticise the author for presenting unfortunate views, since the protagonist himself is one of the main figures of censure in the book. We're not meant to like or respect him, and any issues with what he thinks or says will be part of that meta-narrative. Then, one of the things Leonie from BookTube said about this book in her review was that there seem to be an awful lot of people who misunderstand its message, taking a lot of it at face value and perhaps assuming the protagonist is sympathetic purely because of their status as protagonists, as occurred to me. I'm not sure how that can be true by the book's end unless they're willfully misunderstanding it, because Henry poisons two dogs whilst testing mushrooms to potentially use on Bonnie, and Richard thinks it's funny. And then later there are plenty of other examples of morally reprehensible things the other characters do, so it's pretty clear that by the end you're not meant to think they're good people. Overall, it turns out I remembered almost nothing about this book other than a strong impression that I didn't like it the first time around. In terms of general thoughts, I actually quite enjoyed it this time, at least for most of it, though I do think it's much too long and I was definitely much less invested by the very end. After the thriller-type opening tease of the murder, it immediately turns into a sprawling literary novel that takes far too long to get to the point. Even given its great length, there's a lot of summary compared to the direct action, which makes it difficult to really immerse yourself in the story, especially in the first 250 pages. That said, without the forced tension of the prologue and the occasional heavy-handed references to the shocks and doom to come, I think it would stand on its own as an in-depth character study, and it really does have a lot of very beautiful language and imagery. And at the points where things do come to a head, the tension really pulls you along wanting to know what's going to happen, even when you already know. I do know there are people who rank this book alongside either the best or worst books they've ever read. I don't see how it could engender that much emotion in either direction. I can see how some people might find it really boring and other people might find it really compelling. I lean more in the latter direction, but not so far as to fall off the cliff of desperate love for it. But I don't think anyone could really argue that it's badly written or that it's mind-blowingly good, but then the world would be a very tedious place if we all thought the same about everything. For me, it's a 3.5 star book, I think. I thought it might take me most of the month to read it in the way I wanted to for this episode, but I actually finished it in 12 days, on top of reading 3 other books and listening to 1.5 audiobooks. So resurrecting this project has certainly invigorated my reading, so long may it continue. And then, looking back to my original review, which turns out to have been in June 2010, so a bit longer ago than I thought, here's what I said the first time around. The Secret History by Donna Tartt tells the story of a group of incredibly pretentious college students who descend into murder and madness after trying to stage an authentic bacchanal. I think the book would have had more impact on me 10 or 12 years ago when I was still a pretentious college student myself. I like to think I have a bit more sense and a bit more grasp of reality now, so I wasn't seduced by their mysterious powers of attraction. I actually didn't like any of the characters much at all, but that didn't stop the book from being well written, interesting and gripping right to the end. The denouement actually shocked me. About 150 pages from the end, I really couldn't see where the plot could possibly be going, and I didn't guess later on either. It's not exactly a jolly book, all in all, but it's a good exploration of the dangers of wanting to fit in and the potential doom of associated with trying too hard to make life meaningful. So apparently I've backtracked in my ability to avoid being seduced by glamorous and mysterious elitist characters in books, which is a bit worrying. And I was also completely wrong in thinking that I didn't like this book the first time around. Seems like the ending didn't disappoint me as much in 2010 either, so overall I still enjoyed it, but in different ways. And that's it for this episode of Resurrected Reviews Revisited. I thought about not teasing what I'm going to be doing next in case it all goes awry and I end up wanting to do something different. But I think I'm going to commit to the process and tie myself into completing each piece of selected media, because it would be pretty boring if I only followed through on things I ended up liking on the revisit. So, in the next Resurrected Reviews Revisited episode, I'm looking at Illuminae by Jay Kristoff and Amy Kaufman. Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell me about a time you revisited some media and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email me at willyoustillloveit@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Specific questions? Does anybody really want to listen to me talk about my thoughts on specific books for upwards of half an hour? I'm not sure I want to know the answer to that question, but still... Are you one of the people who ranks The Secret History among either their favourite or least favourite books? If so, why? Lastly, please join us for the next main episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow in 2 weeks to hear what happens when our friends Kate and Jeremy get us to watch The Court Jester, a film from way back in 1955. Will Dave and I like it at all, and will Kate and Jeremy still love it after our discussion? I'm looking forward to finding out. Bye for now.